Hello, and welcome to our podcast provided by Medicom Worldwide. Today, we're going to be talking about the role of the emergency department in the treating of multiple myeloma in the era of novel immunotherapies. My name is Dr. Joshua Richter. I'm an associate professor of medicine at the Tisch Cancer Institute, Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and the director of myeloma at the Blavatnik Family Chelsea Medical Center at Mount Sinai. I'm joined today by two amazing colleagues, which I'll have them introduce themselves. The first is the illustrious Dr. Monica Watana.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for joining. I am a board-certified emergency medicine physician, and I am an associate professor and director of education at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Larissa Sanchez. I am an assistant professor of medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai here in New York City.
So this is a companion podcast to our accredited activity in which we'll talk through a series of cases and talk about practical applied strategies in the emergency department that clinicians can use to treat adverse events which may occur in patients who are being treated for multiple myeloma with some of our novel immunotherapies, such as bispecific antibodies and the CAR T therapies. If you haven't viewed our accredited video yet, you can use the link below, and I encourage you to do so, as it's an important discussion of novel treatments for multiple myeloma and potential treatment-related adverse events, especially those that you might see in the emergency department.
And so when we're talking about emergency management approach to these novel therapeutics, when you think of an emergency in the emergency department, it never happens in an ideal time when clinics are open. It usually happens at 3 a.m. because, you know, that's life. And so really stressing what my colleague Josh said, this podcast and the stuff that we're going to be talking about is really going to be helpful because we will help you deal with that patient at 3 a.m. when maybe the oncologist is hard to reach, when maybe, you know, the emergency department is really, really busy and you have to manage multiple things at once. So the first thing I want you guys to think about as emergency physicians is a history of present illness. What is bringing this patient to the emergency department? When did these symptoms start? Because if you went into emergency medicine like me, we don't want to hear about something that happened a month ago, 6 months ago, because maybe it doesn't really have to deal and do with, you know, why they're here right now. And I want to have you guys extend that time course. I'm going to invite my colleagues to tell you why when it comes to complications of these novel therapeutics. Josh, do you want to help me with, let's go with CAR T first.
Sure. So CAR T, for those of you who may be a little bit less familiar with this, CAR T is an acronym standing for chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy. And in this process, we apherese or collect the patient's T cells. We engineer them ex vivo to attack the cancer and then reinfuse them into a patient's system in order to fight off their malignancy, in this case, multiple myeloma. Now, typically, this process occurs in the hospital and patients receive their infusion of engineered T cells and then remain hospitalized for approximately the next 14 days. And it's during this time period where we see the majority of the acute immune-related events like CRS and ICANS. However, we have certainly noticed that patients can have these delayed toxicities and may subsequently present with the emergency department with them. However, the majority of people who are going to have ramifications of CAR-T after discharge are going to be infectious in nature.
That's super helpful. And Larissa, can you just give a little bit of information about bispecific antibodies? When can we expect these symptoms?
Of course. So, you know, a little bit different than bispecific antibodies. Really, bispecific antibodies are, you can think about it as a hybrid molecule. So basically will bind to the cancer cell and then the patient's endogenous T cells within them. And they're a bit different in that they're not, you know, we don't engineer them, they're off the shelf. So the dosing strategy is a bit different than it is for CAR T, in that the way that we typically dose patients is we admit them for initial step up dosing. And it's during this time that we often tend to see the most CRS events that tend to occur. So that's during the hospitalization where patients are admitted for step up. However, patients, you know, are oftentimes discharged, you know, shortly thereafter once CRS resolves and they come back to the clinic to continue with full doses of these medications, which are usually on a weekly or biweekly basis. And it is still possible for CRS events to happen, you know, even within the first cycle. So this is something that we do think about. You know, there are slightly different risk profiles for different bispecifics, but as Josh mentioned, infection is also important. So another important consideration for patients who receive bispecific treatment.
So what I'm hearing is really we have to extend our time course to consider events that happen, within a month, which is definitely a little bit of a difference in just a mentality change so that, we have a higher index of suspicion for these things. And then I also have a question of, how frequently am I as a medicine physician going to see these severities in the emergency department for CAR T?
So this is a complicated scenario because literally as we're filming this podcast, the day of this filming, the FDA has already moved one of the CAR T assets to earlier line therapy. And we expect an additional one any time now, meaning that there are an increasing number of patients in the United States that are going to be receiving these therapies. And although at the moment they're mostly given in academic centers, patients can frequently receive the CAR T and then return back to their primary oncologic providers. And subsequently, they may then get admitted to the emergency department with some of these delayed reactions. So the short answer is bispecifics are becoming quite more available. CAR Ts are becoming more available. And this is something I think our emergency departments need to prepare for.
Yeah, especially if it's like what you're saying, it's going to be happening more. And, community physicians and these community emergency departments have different resources as well. And so if we're going to be seeing this more frequently overall, this is definitely something to consider and think about.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, I think that's a great point that you raised, Josh. Especially when bispecifics were coming out into this field, initial dosing was in the hospital. Now we're starting to think about outpatient dosing for even step up. With the caveat, yes, we want patients to be around our academic centers when we're starting the step up dosing in case a CRS event happens, but it's possible that they may end up going to a more, community setting if they were an hour away because that was the closest center. So I think really something that's going to be coming into the forefront for our emergency room docs.
And so, yes, Larissa, can you give me a little bit more insight into what symptoms as an emergency medicine doctor should I be thinking about when I'm thinking about cytokine release syndrome, which is one of the main side effects for both CAR T and bispecifics?
Sure. So, again, as a companion, I think a lot of this information was probably reviewed, but when we're thinking about CRS in general, really what is driving this is a systemic response to activated T cells, right? So there's a lot of the driver here are cytokines, typically IL-6, IL-1, and that is really ca causing the systemic inflammatory response that can really affect any organ of the body. The most common thing that we will see, as you might expect in any systemic inflammation, is fever. That's typically kind of the most the mild end of the spectrum. And oftentimes, fever can be accompanied by headaches, myalgias, sometimes exacerbation of pain. And when we're thinking about this on a systemic basis, but there could be, end organ dysfunctions that could be seen, such as transaminitis. So I think really it's just important to think about CRS as a systemic, inflammatory response, and we have to be mindful that it can really affect any organ system, especially the neurologic system too, which we'll get into later.
So basically, in a nutshell, what you're saying is that, any system is fair game and any chief complaint is possible. As a as an emergency medicine trained physician, that is our bread and butter. But there is things that we can do to, help our oncologists since this really is a diagnosis of exclusion and how these patients present. It's really, really think of it as a big sliding scale from really subtle to really, really severe. And so having that high index of suspicion at all times for any system possible is going to be really key. And that sometimes can be hard. And so we'll give you a sample case that might help you guys to see how having a high index of suspicion is important while doing what you do best, which is treating sick patients, is necessary. And so in this case, let's say you have a patient that is brought back to one of your resuscitation rooms because they're sick, really, really sick, meaning their heart rate's high, they're tachycardic, maybe let's say it's 126, they're febrile, their temp is 38.4, and they're hypotensive. Blood pressure, let's say it's systolic is 82, diastolic 55. They are breathing a little bit fast. Respiratory rate is about 26, and then they're saturating low on room air, 80% on room air is going to be the number that I'm going to give you guys. In our heads, when you have someone that is febrile, hypotensive, tachycardic. There's a big differential that as emergency medicine physicians, we're trained to think of and we're trained to work up. And the first thing I want to tell you guys is do that. Do what we do best. And so when I think of this patient, I'm thinking of sepsis, maybe from a pneumonia source, potentially, depending on the physical exam, think of heart failure or other pulmonary etiologies that require workup with pulmonary imaging to see why a patient's hypoxic, why they're tachycardic. In conjunction to doing what we do best, doing workup to rule out those broad differential diagnosis of severe symptoms such as pulmonary embolism, sepsis. We're treating for those things. I really want to recommend everybody to treat for sepsis. If someone is febrile and hypotensive, treat for sepsis. But also, if they are on some of these novel therapeutics, I'd like to ask my colleagues, my oncologist colleagues, to help me basically to give me some advice in terms of labs or other imaging that you guys would like so that you can help make this diagnosis of exclusion. Because in the emergency department, when all of this is happening at once, usually we're not going to be making this diagnosis.
Sure. So I can jump in. And, I think one of the things that you bring up, which is fair, what you see is what you get. So this is the patient that's going to present, and we can talk about the labs that we would want and we would want instantly in an ideal setting as if it were a presentation on a board exam. So yeah, I would love to have things like a lactic acid and a procalcitonin and a ferritin and a CRP. But we all know that if this patient is going to present in the middle of the night, we may not have access to those tests and/or the results right away. So I think one of the things, Monica, that you brought up, which is the absolute key here, is to have this as an index of suspicion. If this patient comes in and they're on their chart or from report from a family member with them that they're receiving a therapy like a bispecific or a CAR T. To me, this is where, to use the expression, shoot first and ask questions later, I would strongly consider adding on a dose of dexamethasone in this case. And to me, this is kind of like the way we've seen COPD exacerbations treated, where sometimes we give the antibiotics and the steroids to calm down the inflammation, knowing that high doses and extended periods of steroids may hamper the immune system, but one dose, I think, is probably warranted if there's any clinical suspicion for CRS.
That's so helpful. And a lot of us have in our institutions, we have ordering panels. And so I am glad that Josh brought up the fact that, things that we aren't used to ordering a lot, such as the ferritin levels, ESR, CRP, are going to be helpful because they are tracked in clinic. And so if you are thinking that the patient does have CRS, add those on along with the procalcitonin and lactic acid we usually get. And so talk to me about the grading system. So how do I know how severe a patient is? Because if they're in my emergency department and already symptomatic in my head, they are already severe.
Sure. So I'm happy to take this. So when we look at the CRS grade, ranges from grade 1 to 4. So usually grade 1, mild fever, constitutional symptoms. They're just generally feeling unwell. But when we start getting into the higher grades, is when we really start seeing more, end organ dysfunction. So grade 2 generally is hypotension, which is responsive to fluids. And hypoxia, which requires basically nasal cannula to help to improve. So really the grading now depends on blood pressure status and oxygenation status when we go through the grading. When we move on to grade 3, this is now hypotension that's refractory to IV fluids requiring pressors, and hypoxia now that may be requiring a greater level of support moving away from nasal cannula to potentially like non-rebreather, et cetera, like really requiring more help here. And then grade 4 is mechanical ventilation, requiring more pressor support, transfer to the ICU is when we start thinking about the grade 4 event.
I want to press on my colleagues that are listening to this podcast. If a patient is visiting you in the emergency department, most likely they're already grade 2 or higher. They're not going to be presenting at 3 a.m. For something that is asymptomatic. And so already think about treatment. And if like what Larissa just said, if the patient needs to be transferred to higher level care, if you are in an institution or in, an urgent care that doesn't have capability for the treatments for these patients. And then just so that my colleagues get a better understanding, because CAR T and bispecifics are different, how frequently can I expect a patient to be presenting in grade 3 or grade 4 for bispecifics versus CAR T?
So, based on clinical trial data that we have, most CRS events actually are grade 1 or 2, whether that be CAR T or bispecifics. CAR T therapies, slightly higher rates of CRS overall compared to bispecifics, ranging maybe more from like that 70 to 90%, whereas bispecifics, like up to 70% of patients will develop some type of CRS, and really grade 3 or 4. For both bispecifics and CAR T, like less than 5%, should be seen.
And one thing I'd love to add is, I think Larissa did a phenomenal job of going through the 1, 2, 3, and 4 grading system. And we all know once a patient is in the ER, if the patient is requiring pressor support or mechanical ventilation, that's an automatic ticket to the intensive care unit. But one of the things that we've done at our center, and I know you guys have done at your centers, and we encourage other centers who are going into the field of giving these type of drugs, is have good conversations between the emergency department, oncology department, and the ICU to consider transfer to ICU for someone with, for even sometimes a grade 2 CRS, because if they're starting to worsen, these patients can turn quite quickly. So even though the typical requirements of pressor support and mechanical ventilation are the barrier you have to get above, we have had agreements from our ICU that if we see a patient that we're concerned at, they're on their second liter of fluid, that we haven't given the full chance yet, but we're heading in that direction, they might accept them sooner to prevent us having an urgent transfer to the ICU.
That's so helpful to give some advice on. And so from an emergency medicine perspective, depending on where you work, if you're already seeing grade 2, you might be considering transfer to a higher level of care facility, even when their vital signs are within normal limits and their grading scale number is not that high. And so that's definitely something to consider. Larissa, can you just go over with me again in terms of, grades versus treatments? What's the standard that they're suggesting?
Sure. So, as I mentioned before, when thinking about the pathophysiology, really driven usually by IL-6. So that is really the mainstay of therapy and trying to reverse these this inflammatory event that happens with CRS. So, I think we're moving a lot towards, at least in academic centers, really at the first onset of very mild CRS fever, we actually do give tocilizumab, which is anti-IL-6 therapy, to decrease that inflammatory response and even allow us to get through more, step up dosing. So this really is the backbone of treatment for CRS. So again, grade 1 can sometimes be monitored. If it's prolonged, then anti-IL-6 therapy. If not improved with anti-IL-6 therapy, moves on to now using corticosteroids like dexamethasone to continue to try to decrease that inflammatory response. And oftentimes, if patients do have grade 2 from the onset, then absolutely someone should get tocilizumab to start with, potentially dex if it does not resolve in a timely fashion. So those are really the two main agents that we have.
And since a lot of institutions, even other academic centers, might not have tocilizumab, really think about transferring, or as Larissa said, giving that first dose of high dose steroids if you're somewhere that does not have tocilizumab, will be really, really key.
Just to add a little bit, we do, there's an alternative called cetuximab, which is another anti-IL-6, just to throw out because I think whenever these patients come in, another key partner in all of this is going to be our pharmacy colleagues about what therapeutics we have at our advantage. So absolutely, toci, as Larissa pointed out, is the way to go. If we don't have that, cetuximab is another option, but every emergency department out there has steroids.
That we do. And moving on, given that every emergency department has steroids, Josh, can you talk to us about the second side effect that me, as an emergency medicine physician, my colleagues listening in, will need to consider on these new novel therapeutics?
Sure. And this one I think is even harder in many ways. So this is ICONS, which is immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity syndrome. And this is mediated by exactly what Larissa was talking about. You get those activated T cells, they start cranking out these cytokines like IL-1. And now those T cells are going to cross through the blood-brain barrier here and start causing neurologic issues. Now, this also runs a huge gamut, everything from a headache, which people may have just from listening to my voice, all the way through seizures, comatose, altered mental status. It really can run a wild gamut. So it is really, really difficult sometimes to tease this out, especially in the early grades, as to what's causing it. And because we may have a variety of patients that have some baseline neurologic dysfunction, if there's any way to figure out what their baseline is, that might help distinguish ICONS from some concomitant other neurological issues.
I see. And when you say baseline, when you're in the clinics monitoring these patients, what are you doing to determine what their baseline is? And what can I continue when I'm seeing this patient in the emergency department, whether it's in the waiting room, in, the not ideal situation versus in a busy emergency department setting?
So, I think the hardest part about seeing these patients in the emergency room as opposed to our clinic is we see these patients over long periods of time. We know their baseline. We know when things are off. When they come into the emergency room, it's hard to have a frame of reference. So, ideally, if the patient has a family member with them or there's a family member to call to say, hey, I'm here with your uncle. He's a little confused. Is this new for him? When did this start? I think that context really helps. What we use in the clinic is something called the ICE score. The ICE score is a 10-point scoring system that evaluates things like orientation, naming, and most specifically, handwriting. It actually turns out that things like micrographia and dysgraphia can be some of the earlier telltale signs of ICONS. So what we actually have patients do when they're receiving initial therapy with CAR T or bispecifics is have them write a daily sentence. So you could always have the patient write a sentence while they're waiting to be evaluated. And if things are all over the place, that might be a sign that this is ICONS.
To my colleagues out there, basically, when we're evaluating a patient that is on bispecifics, especially, everything is subtle. And so your favorite chief complaints of just not feeling well, maybe I feel a little off balance, that is how they're going to present. And I don't know about any of you, but before these treatments came out, I never got a sample of anybody's handwriting in a busy waiting room, nor do I have a piece of paper. And so that's why I really wanted to tell you guys and, get our colleagues on board to say, hey, this is actually important. So, get out that pen that, is hiding somewhere since, most of us are on, electronic medical record now, and actually ask what sentence they usually write in clinic. And an easy way to, help facilitate if the oncologist is able to be contacted is you can take a screenshot of that and either put it in their electronic medical record or text it to them because they'll know what the patient's handwriting looked like and if it's changed. And these changes are that subtle. And it's really difficult to evaluate when, the patient's in a waiting room. But also, Josh mentioned the ICE score. The ICE score is really, really important as well. But you don't have to memorize it. There's calculators that are available now. You just need to remember that there is a score and it's included when you're thinking about and having a high index of suspicion that a patient might be having ICONS. And so tell me more about the grading then.
Sure. So the grading, just like Larissa described for CRS, goes on a scale from grade one to grade four, with gradual worsening. And it's really tied into that ICE score. So you have all 10 out of 10 points. You don't have ICONS, but a grade of 7 to 9 or score of 7 to 9 is grade one, grade of 6 is grade two, 0 to 2 is grade three. And if you're literally completely unarousable and not able to answer the questions, that's a grade four. In terms of how we approach treating this and what this is associated with, grade one ICONS can be very, very subtle, can even be things as simple as a headache. And, how many patients in an ER right now have a headache? That's really hard to tell. And oftentimes for grade one, we don't start doing anything. It's really when we're really have an index of suspicion for grade two or higher ICONS that we start intervening.
And I think that's really helpful for us to know too, because a lot of times patients for if they're on treatments with bispecifics, they will present with subtle chief complaints. And I just wanted to get a good sense as to, what is the percentage for in your own patient population, for your patients that you've sent to the Mercy Department, how severe are they usually? How many, severe grade 3/4s have you sent versus, the grade ones?
One of the things that we're seeing is actually a rise in more severe cases. So, although, as Larissa described with CRS, the general rates of grade 3/4 ICANS are very low. We're talking about single digits in the CAR Ts or the bispecifics. The reality is that as these therapies move from clinical trial to standard of care, move from standard of care in academic centers to standard of care in community centers. And as again, on a clinical trial, you have to be fit all the inclusion and exclusion criteria, but you can treat a sicker or more advanced or more aggressive cancer patient with these in standard of care. We're starting to see a higher incidence anecdotally when we're giving these therapies. So we've sent a couple of grade 3/4s within the last few months to our ER, and it was very scary.
And so, to my colleagues, I think the biggest thing that I want to impress upon is with just our basic emergency medicine training, you are very well equipped to be working these patients up in the emergency department and treating the worst of the worst patients. Like Josh said initially, they can be presenting with like status epilepticus or with vasogenic edema. Those things we know how to manage. It's more of the subtle findings to make sure that you have that high index of suspicions, that you can still work them up as if you were working up a patient that potentially might be getting worse and might present with status. Because a lot of times, if a patient has just a low-grade headache, if I didn't ask the right questions, I might not get that CT scan. And when you're working these patients up in the emergency department, the grading for ICANS involves imaging. And even though the imaging might be negative, it's part of it and it's useful to get to rule out other diagnoses, which as an emergency medicine physician, that really is our job, just ruling out other worst case scenarios so that the oncologist can drill down and really treat ICANS if that's it. And so let's talk more about this grading system because especially with subtlety, especially with the workups, as an emergency medicine physician, I need to know, when do you want to be called? Do you want to be called with every person that has a headache? Because if you want, I can, but it might be, pretty bothersome to you guys as well. And so in terms of communication, what would you guys prefer?
So I can tell you, the surrogate for us is at the current time, we're administering most of these on the inpatient side during the initial dosing. But exactly as Larissa described, it's moving to the outpatient. But what this means is that right now, when the majority of these events happen, it's a nurse practitioner, a PA, or a physician giving us a call in the middle of the night that the inpatient is developing this. And I think early intervention here is important. So I would prefer a call earlier on rather than later. And consider ICE one of the vital signs. So when our NPs call us at 2 o'clock in the morning that Mr. Smith is having some event, they'll say, Mr. Smith, here are his vital signs, his O2 sat, here's his blood pressure, temperature, all of that. ICE is 10 out of 10. It's part of that initial assessment, whether or not it's CRS or ICANS. Anytime there's any immune-related adverse event, it's part of the vital signs and better to call us early on than later.
I think that's really helpful. And, with these new therapeutics, just impressing on everyone that is tuning in on this podcast that we actually play a really vital role. And it's not a role where the emergency medicine physician is operating a silo, isolated anymore. It's almost like since these patients are being monitored frequently, we are, integral in their care. And so letting the treating team know earlier, even if it's at night, about a concern that we might have actually is helpful. And as Josh just said, it's actually welcome. So I definitely agree to say, hey, give your patient's oncologist a call if you even suspect that they might be having a side effect from their treatments. And so when we're talking about these treatments for the different grades, can you just go over what I should be thinking about for ICANS in these patients, and what should I initiate within the emergency department?
Sure. So kind of the first pass we think about is obviously what grade the ICANS is. But then the second pass is what is the relationship to CRS? because you can have CRS without ICONS, ICONS without CRS, or both together. Commonly, when you have ICONS, it's coming along with or just after CRS. Not always, but it happens to happen most of the time that way. The reason why this has an impact is because, as Larissa pointed out, drugs like tocilizumab are going to be our first-line approach for the majority of CRS. Toci does not cross the blood-brain barrier. So if you're having ICONS without CRS, there is actually no role for tocilizumab. However, if you have a patient who's having CRS and ICONS, you're still, as a first pass, going to give something like tocilizumab. But in general, once we get beyond that, or if you don't have concomitant CRS, dexamethasone is going to be our first pass. So dexamethasone, 10 milligrams IV times one. You can continue that up to Q6 hours. If that doesn't work, we oftentimes, as the grade of ICONS goes up to grade two or grade three, we start considering the addition of anakinra, also known as Kineret, the anti-IL-1 therapy. Dosages ranging from around 1 to 200 milligrams, sub-Q Q8 hours. As a next step, you can even escalate the steroids to high-dose methylprednisolone up to a gram QD to BID up to 3 days. But as we're getting up to these higher levels, you really need to start thinking about neuroimaging, transfer evaluation by the ICU, and anti-epileptic therapy, even if there's no evidence of the patient seizing at that time, because this can progress to status epilepticus. So I think that's kind of the pathway we generally follow.
That's really helpful. And so, if I'm considering transferring a patient out of my institution for higher level of care, you do recommend starting anti-epileptic therapy.
Yeah, I think in a day and age where, I think many years ago, back when I started practicing, it was all Dilantin. But I think nowadays that Keppra seems to be one of the main drugs of choice to load a patient where you have concern for progression to status epilepticus. I think risk benefit is there. There's no problem starting the anti-epileptic therapy and discontinuing it later on. I think because these patients may require transfer, nothing would be worse than having a patient go into status during the hospital ambulance transfer. So again, when in doubt, I think pushing a little bit harder here with the protective therapy is a good idea.
That's really, really helpful.
So I think we've heard a lot of really great points from our colleagues in terms of how to manage these patients. But with all of this, let's try to boil it down to the bare essentials of what you need to walk away with. So Larissa, you're getting a call in the middle of the night from our ER colleagues. What do you want them to know about a patient where you have a concern for CRS or ICONS?
Sure. I think for all of our emergency room colleagues, history is so key. When did this patient receive this most recent treatment that they were on? Because that's really going to be the key data point that we need as oncologists to help guide in whether this is going to be infection or CRS or whatever else there may be on the differential. And I think I've made this analogy before. Timing and intervention is extremely important. So similarly to our stop sepsis campaigns, right? I think stop CRS is really key. So when we recognize it early, we can intervene early with the appropriate medications to really try to improve a patient outcome and decrease morbidity. So I really think that is the key point here. History taking early intervention.
And Monica, throwing it at you, I think one of the points you bring up that is most critical here is that the emergency department is not siloed. They're a critical part of the care team. What would be the final bullet points you would want to impart to your other emergency room colleagues?
I think the most important thing to think about is that I want to instill confidence in all of you because our training is excellent. Wherever you get trained as an emergency medicine physician, you are able to handle these complications, even the biggest, broadest range of spectrum for CRS or ICONS. But it's the index of suspicion that I just want to impress upon because a lot of this is subtle and it's easy to miss even. Most smartest person can miss a lot of things when a bajillion things are going on at once. And so really having the high index of suspicion and asking the right questions will be really, really key for us to nail the diagnosis or help our colleagues to nail the diagnosis once they're admitted. And then also the second thing is we all practice in different environments. And so if you are somewhere that does not have tocilizumab or higher level of care, transfer early or call the patient's oncologist if they're available to consider initiating transfer for higher level of care so that these patients do not get worse sooner.
I think this has been an absolute wonderful podcast, really the archetype for the way modern medicine ought to behave, which is complete collaboration across subspecialties, including emergency medicine, oncology, along with our pharmacy colleagues, our ICU colleagues, neuro colleagues. It's really, it takes a village. And with that, I would really like to thank the viewing audience for listening to this podcast. If you haven't had a chance yet to view our companion accredited activity yet, please be sure to check it out in the link below for a complete picture of potential treatment-related adverse events associated with some of these novel immunotherapies for multiple myeloma and how these patients might present to the emergency department.